So I hold myself in contempt if you try to pull me up here to court with that attorney.
The questions here, carjacker Willie.
Objection.
I'm going to allow it. It characterizes the defendant as a carjacker.
You didn't kill Thompson, but you did, Mr. Wells.
Yes, I killed Ed Thompson. I killed him.
Order. The whole trial is out of order. They're out of order.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 300. Woo! And we very on purpose timed that from the beginning, actually, from when we started the show, we decided episode 300 would be when Bob Mueller testified. It seemed weird at the time, but that is what we did. I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is P. Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am decompressing from 3.5 hours of watching someone who really, really didn't want to testify before the House of Representatives. So I'm excited to share our thoughts with our listener. I'm really, really glad we're gonna crank this out early. I think there are a few kind of legal things that are worth going through, but longtime listeners of the show will already be familiar with those legal things. So.
Aren't you going to ask me how I'm doing?
Thomas, how are you doing?
I'm not going to answer that. That's outside the scope of the my pod. That's in the refer to my podcast report that I sent you in your inbox, Andrew. I'm not going to answer that. I'm going to speak to that. How am I doing?
When you say inbox, can you tell us?
I'm not going to answer that. Is it in my report? It is in my. Okay, then yeah, that. Then that's my answer. Was it in my report? Do you have my report? Where's my report?
Could you read from your report?
No. I don't know. What was he there for? Anyway. Okay, we'll get into it. important announcement first, though. We have a live show coming up, and I'm checking the internet, and the internet is telling me there are exactly 10 beautiful, glorious Wayne Stock tickets left for this live show in New York. August 10th, 10. That's it. So if 11 of you want to go, you don't have to outrun the bear. You just got to outrun the one guy. So go jump on it. That's the link's in the show notes. It's going to be tremendous fun. You need to be there. Go check it out.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. See, is that everything? I mean, any other announcements? I'm a little, it's not that we weren't playing on recording. I just woke up. I actually was up early because of Phoebe. And still, I missed 7 hours of the thing. What time do these things start? The West Coast people, God forbid you live in Hawaii. What are you supposed to do? This started at like 1 a.m. my time and went from 1 to 5 a.m. I woke up what I thought was early at 7:30 a.m. and it was already over. So I missed the first half, but I'm glad you're here to tell us what happened.
Yeah, I was shocked that we got, because all of the advance warning was that the testimony was going to start at 9 o'clock, and 8:30, Jerry Nadler gaveled the House committee into session and swore in Bob Mueller. You and I think gave some top line reactions in the show intro banter here. One of the things that I want to pass along, because it strongly informs how I look at Mueller's testimony, is some reporting from our friend Natasha Bertrand, who said that, and we retweeted this out on the OA Twitter feed at Open Arcs, that Mueller told the House Democrats he would not read from his report during his testimony. And I think that's, yeah, I think that's really, really critical, because prior to Natasha telling us that, I had tweeted out, guys, the way to do this is not for bloviating third-term congressmen from, you know, Pennsylvania to read part, and I'm not picking an individual one. I'm just saying it's not for a Democratic congressperson to read from the report and then say, do you agree with it? And have Robert Mueller go, yep, that's in my report, right? Like, that's not an effective way to introduce testimony. The effective way to introduce testimony is to set up the questions like this. Director Mueller, the first standard for obstruction of justice is that there's an overt act, right? And then he would say, I defer to my report. And he would say, okay, in fact, you cover that on volume 2, page 135 of your report. Can you read that beginning at line 6, right? And that's typically how lawyers would interrogate a witness, you know, particularly a nominally friendly witness who's sort of being uncooperative in any kind of legal proceeding. You would just say, okay, you're going to defer to the document. You're going to say the document speaks for itself. I want you to read that document in your words into the record. And apparently Mueller said he wasn't going to do that.
I just want to know who died and made this guy king of Earth is what I want to know. Like, who, what am I nuts? Why does Mueller get to decide the rules of everything? Is co-equal branch? He's not even in government anymore, right? He's just a civilian.
Yeah, no, he's a guy now.
He's a guy. And the Congress of your United States has called upon you to testify. And you're like, well, okay. I mean, I'll say it, whatever. I'm not going to read anything. I'm not going to answer any questions. I will kind of, like, if you say something's in the report, then I'll say, okay, but I'm not going to read anything in the report. Like, what? Is this normal?
No, it's very not normal. And the reason that this is abnormal is that I can't think in recent memory of a witness that has been in the position that Bob Mueller is in. And we're going to talk about this because obviously part of the idiot Republican game plan now is the Robert Mueller, lifelong Republican, appointed to every governmental office he's ever held by Republicans, is some kind of like crazy, you know, Bernie Sanders supporting leftist. Notwithstanding that fact, right, what you have is a situation where somebody who is a lifelong conservative Republican, appointed to that position by Rod Rosenstein, lifelong conservative Republican, and if you're the Democrats, it's the only explanation for this. You are terrified of colloquially treating Robert Mueller as hostile.
Yeah, right. So that's what I was going to say. He has everybody hostage, essentially, because it's like, you know, obviously Republicans went at him a little bit, but they can't go at him that much because he's a Republican. Like, there's only so much they can do. And then on the Democratic side, they know that they can't badger this guy, or they can't be like, are you out of your mind? Like, you're here. You know, they can't treat him in any way that's going to diminish his image in the public, because he's what little we have. You know, like, yep. Mueller is the tiny amount that we have. So they have to prop him up and just take it. So a bunch of Congress people are just having to take this from Bob Mueller. It drives me insane. It really does.
Yeah. And me too. And you can see this if you go back, particularly in the first half. And I know you missed that first part.
At 5 a.m. I was doing this thing called sleeping
in the morning.
Yeah.
you have absolutely, there was no aspersions being cast there.
Right,
that was I think.
No, I know. I'm just further annoyed at the scheduling.
Very lengthy service to this country and this podcast, Mr. Smith. but you'll see Congressman Collins from Georgia, really, really effective. Again, evil, but effective, and we have to call this out when it is, in doing the kind of lawyerly cross-examination that the Democrats, to a person, were afraid to do, and in my view, clearly could have gotten away with, and that is this, right? You ask a question, the witness says, That's in my report. And then before you move on to the next question, you say, so that answer is yes. Okay, next question, right?
And just fill it in.
And you just, right. You don't have to bulldozer over him the way Collins did. I mean, Collins definitely, you know, drove a steamroller over him. But it's a typical tactic when somebody won't give you a yes or no answer. You know this in a deposition, right? Is you ask the question, they say, well, I defer to the document. And then you say, okay, so that's a yes. And then it puts the onus on the witness to then say, well, no, that the document isn't a yes. And then you can get them to answer your question in the first place, right? You can be like, oh, in what way does the document not support what I just asked, right? And it forces you to be specific. And there were a couple of times when Mueller actually did that with the Republicans. We can talk about that. I don't believe he would have done that with the Democrats. And I don't believe this is a career prosecutor, right? This is somebody who eats, sleeps, breathes lawyerly stuff, right? Like I don't think he would have been so offended that he would have given harmful answers or otherwise upbraided the Democrats if they had asked those questions in a more and now we go to the technical definition of treating as hostile in a more leading format. Right. OK, so that's a yes answer. Moving on.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a big miss. But let me ask you sort of before we get through, I can infer some. But what's your top line view of the aftermath of Mueller's testimony?
It's a hard question. I mean, we're just to clarify for everybody, because maybe the hours will matter here. We're going right after it. Like we're recording right now. He had just walked out of the hearing basically. So this is not, we haven't gotten the benefit of however many hours of, you know, like coverage of this, just FYI. So going out on a limb right after that and seeing no reaction. I guess I would define it in these terms, and maybe I can get, you know, you to answer this as well. What would success look like? You know, like, would it be, who are we trying to change? Are we trying to measure, like, will Trump's poll numbers change? Are we trying to measure, will Democrats in the House be more persuaded to impeach? Are we trying to go so far as to say, would a Republican member of Congress call for impeachment? Like, how are you defining success first, I guess?
I think that's a great clarification. I would define success as Democrats in the House being more willing to impeach for the argument that you gave on SIO, which is now what I have shamelessly ripped off and repeat at every opportunity, which is the process of impeachment itself, the process of putting Trump witnesses in their own words on the stand, being cross-examined by managers appointed by the House of Representatives on, you know, primetime television 24/7, getting the same coverage that that the Clinton impeachment got, that I think that process itself is how we get around the fact that Trump has otherwise gotten around the media by communicating directly to his base. Right. Like, so I realized that I didn't make that as clear as I could be.
Yeah.
Been wrong. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, just summarizing, right? Like, I have been wrong because I thought the Mueller report was going to be a bombshell, right? I said, I think Bill Barr is going to be impeached, and I think this is huge news, and the news cycle will change after the Mueller report was released. And that didn't happen because members of Congress didn't read it. We saw some of them questioning Mueller today, who very obviously not only had never read the report, but have never listened to anything that isn't Fox News. And they live in this bubble that allows you to disintermediate reality. And so now I've kind of shifted my view to how do we stop that end around, right? Like, how do we do our best to get people out of only following Trump's tweets? And I think the impeachment process is our best effort at that. So.
Right. So to going back to the question, then, I guess if you're defining success as some number of Democrats will change their minds in the House about beginning impeachment, I think it will change some minds. I actually do. I think it's enough, especially because obviously the quote unquote bombshell, which we all already knew. We got Bob Mueller said a thing that everybody should have already known. Like literally every citizen, if you paid attention for 5 seconds, should have already known that if the president were not in office, he could be charged. Like everybody should know that. We've said it a million times. There's no excuse, really, other than the Fox News, you know, misinformation machine and just not paying attention. But anyway, the fact that he said those magic words that we all already knew, he said them out loud. Maybe that moves a couple of Democrats to be like, well, then I guess we have to do something about this. Like, clearly, if Mueller is saying he would be charged but for, you know, being in office, then that means, ergo, we have to do something about it. And actually, toward the end of the hearing, there was a cute little interaction where someone was asking, I don't remember who, but one of the Congress... what do they call? They call it Congresswomen, or it was like Congress. The chairman was using some weird terms for female members of Congress, and it was
I like members of Congress, but
yeah, me too. But he was saying like Congress ladies or something. Like it was something. It wasn't that, but it was something that threw me off.
That seems a little 1835.
I know that's what I was saying. I was wondering if you'd remember what that was. It was so weird to me that I already can't recreate it. But anyway, yeah, female members of Congress, one way or the other. She asked him, you know, what are some of the potential remedies for this kind of thing? And he said, well, I think you've already mentioned one, you know, because he actually listed in the report, you know, here's what could be done. And that one, of course, is impeachment. So, yeah, I mean, maybe it'll move a couple people to actually do what the report says. I don't know. Do you think they were already on that path eventually anyway? We haven't gotten a chance to talk a lot about your view of Pelosi. You know, like I've been wondering like how much you think, you know, do you still have faith in Pelosi with all that's happened and how she's still not allowing impeachment to go forward?
Okay, so
there's a lot there.
So I want to answer that. I want to answer that question and then go back to the previous one. Here's my thoughts on Pelosi. And again, right, this is, you know, what our friends over at Mueller, she wrote, would call super space beans. I think Pelosi is just, we know this about her, right? She is an old school politician, right? She is classic kind of grassroots, you know, blue collar, mobilized Democrats. And I think she firmly believes that the Democrats can win in 2020 just by running a normal campaign. And I think she is concerned that if the House moves to impeach, that will suck all the energy out of the room for what Democrats want to run on and handicap the Democratic nominee in what is otherwise a winnable race. I couldn't disagree more strongly with that view, right? Like, I think the idea that, you know, the 2020 election is going to be about, right, the policy plans of Liz Warren or Kamala Harris or Kirsten Gillibrand or whatever, right? Like, is to me, like, that's crazy, right? Like, that's going to be
plus,
part of
you can remind me what the text of the Constitution says, but does it say, like, Congress shall, you know, make sure to check the power of the president unless maybe it could question possibly affect your election chances, then don't bother? Is that what it says? Is it something like that?
No, and you're making a really, really good legal argument, right? Which is the Article 2 of the Constitution uses, you heard this in a different context in the Mueller hearings today. It says the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. So look, it says, right? I mean, that's not
unless you think poll numbers might be affected. Is it also what it says?
Yeah, no, it says, right, on impeachment for and conviction of those high crimes and misdemeanors. It the word shall is mandatory. Now, look, right, I don't think anybody would look at that and think you could get, you know, a writ of mandamus to force Nancy Pelosi to bring impeachment proceedings, right? Obviously, there is discretion in the same way that there is discretion in every prosecutorial decision. But you know, the language of the Constitution does not say, this is this, you know, it's kind of, well, you know, figure it out. Now, the language of the Constitution is really, really clear. This is one of the core aspects of separation of powers. And if Congress isn't, if Congress is subordinating that to what do we think is most likely to elect Liz Warren in November of 2020, that in my view, that's a terrible mistake.
Yeah, I agree. We can't, I mean, the idea that we're going to, yeah, I know, that we're going to let him get away with this because politics, like poll numbers, you know, that's just not how it should work. So I guess then what do you think? Do you think this is going to move the needle on any?
So I think.
By the way, trademark opening arguments TM move the needle. Just yeah. grabbing that.
Yeah, yeah. Look for your move the noodle shirts coming soon. I was expecting, I didn't, again, we weren't able to script this episode out because we are literally going 10 minutes after the hearing concluded. And I was coming in prepared to, you know, take the doesn't move the noodle side because of all the reasons that we're about to get into. But then as I was defining what that means, right, makes Democrats in Congress more likely to move towards impeachment. I do think that there was some positive progress, right? Look, you're going to have to separate out, and we're going to talk about this, the next day of the news cycle, right? And I would analogize this, and this is not going to be the world's greatest analogy, but remember the instant reaction to the midterm elections was kind of disappointment, right? And we had to go on and say, no, look, as is proven here, like retaking the House of Representatives was an absolutely huge thing. Yeah. And this was a great win for democracy, small d, and for Democrats. But like that for that instant 12 to 24 hours was Beto was going to win Texas. And I'm, you know, and I got caught up in it, right? And it was like, oh man, not only did Beto not win it, but like, you know, we lost Claire McCaskill and, you know, this is going bad. That's going to cover the news cycle as this show drops, right? Because folks who, you know, have Robert Mueller tattooed on their arm, for example, who were hoping that he was going to, that AG has a tattoo of Mueller in the hallway on her arm. So
wait, for real?
Can I give her thoughts that was on it?
She no, does?
She really? Yeah, she really does.
Wow. That might not age well, but okay.
Yeah. You know, nothing.
He's a Republican. I'm never going to tattoo a Republican on me for any reason. Well, I wore a Democrat anything, but yeah, still, it's the last thing I would do.
I think we know now what if we can subtitle this episode, it's going to be I'm never going to tattoo a Republican.
Tell
on
you what,
me for any
here's
reason.
The here. I just thought of one exception. Donald Trump behind bars would be the one thing that might like a small, just like he's hanging onto the bars, but only if that actually happened. That'll be my. I would almost make that bet. I have no tattoos. Anyway, go on. I don't want to derail you. I'm just surprised by this.
Yeah. So it right. If you were hoping that Robert Mueller was going to come out and say in his own words, no, I didn't make the decision. I handed this off to you. You're the House of Representatives, and there are 10 demonstrable instances of crime. And by God, why haven't you people impeached already? You're going to be disappointed. If you thought, but that was, I mean, that, you know, we talked about that. That was never going to happen. If you thought that at least Comey would be able to explain and in his own words cite from his conclusion, Comey, there's a malapropism. If you thought that Mueller was going to explain and conclude in his own words the findings in his report, then you're also disappointed. And that's where I'm disappointed. The reason Comey snuck in there is because, you know, you called, I mean, we discussed this in a prior episode, and you know, we were talking about how Mueller really is kind of the anti-Comey, right? That it is crystal clear to me from watching his testimony that he does not want to make this about him. And that to the detriment of the Republic, he's willing to do that.
Yeah. And to a degree that doesn't really even make sense. Like, it'd be one thing if he's like, look, I'm not going to answer questions about like my personal life or my hobbies or something. But to say I'm not even going to read from my report, which I've said is the thing I'm going to testify about, that's insane. I mean, well, this is... Go ahead.
No. I didn't mean to interrupt. I wanted to piggyback. I mean, in my view, it's even worse than that, right? Like, it is... for example, you talked about Virginia Escobar's testimony. She's the member of Congress from Texas who went last, right? Who was saying, what did you mean in your report by constitutional processes? And he said, and Mueller said, well, you know, I think you just mentioned one. And the only thing she'd mentioned in the prior predicate was impeachment.
Yeah.
If I had a friendly witness on direct, right, who gave that answer, I would say, respectfully, sir, we can read the report. I am asking you what you meant when you used the phrase constitutional processes in your report. And with all due respect, I can't understand what the report means until you tell me what you meant with those words.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a right. That's not a hostile. That's just a standard lawyer thing.
Yeah, and I don't. That should have been part of what they were allowed to do by Lord and Savior God Robert Mueller, President of Earth, who is apparently in charge of everything. They should have been allowed to do their job, and do stuff like that. It's outrageous to me.
Yeah, I agree with that. So now let's go back. I had said I think this moves the noodle a little bit, and I think we both agree that the. Three or four Democrats really took a swing at this. The person who did the best job was Ted Lieu, who got the soundbite. Yeah, he is. And he got the soundbite. You didn't indict Donald Trump because of the Office of Legal Counsel memorandum, correct? And shockingly, right? I mean, and again, this is really good. This is part of what you do with an uncooperative witness is you keep asking the question and eventually, you know, hope that he'll forget that he's supposed to stonewall you. and immediately after that, he says yes, right? That at that point, you could have stopped watching the hearing. You know, you didn't need to watch anything before or anything after. And I'm going to talk about some of the good and bad stuff.
I was going to say, let's put this in the proper order. Wasn't first the best Democrat actually a Republican who accidentally did the best questioning first? Didn't that happen before that?
Yes.
No progress was being made until a Republican accidentally did a way better job than Democrats, is how I saw the coverage unfold. Could you explain
that was Ken Buck, Republican from Colorado. There were a number of Republicans where I was trying to figure out if they were trying to hedge their bets because they come from, right, maybe districts that are losable districts, you know, non-gerrymandered districts. There are a handful of those still out there. Or if they were just truly too stupid to know the questions they were asking.
Or if it's almost like a hostage situation where they're trying to signal to us, like, no, there is a human inside this Republican robot shell that has to shill for Trump all the time. Like, I'm wink. Can't you see that I'm blinking in a certain pattern? Like, maybe they're accidentally
holding up this paper with today's date on it. Yeah.
Whoops. I just helped the Democrats. That was definitely an accident. But no, that's probably asking too much.
And that's right. And look, like we're joking a little bit, but you want to include as a potential steel man the idea that that they may be engaged in honest inquiry. I don't
now, that
think
one
Ken
person
Buck
was a mosh and
category.
He had to leave. That's the one
guy, founding member of the House Freedom Caucus. But anyway, we've already done a mock.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Harry's Razors. Says here, I should tell you guys about my travel plans for the summer. Well, you know what I'm doing. I will be at the live show in New York, August 10th, of course. And though Andrew and I both sport beards now, since I finally was able to convert Andrew, that doesn't mean we don't use Harry's razors. We absolutely do use Harry's razors because we got to keep that neck beard at bay. You still have to shave. You still got to neaten it up, keep it nice and aerodynamic, keep it looking good. You got to keep the shape nice and good. There's a lot that goes into it. We use Harry's razors. They are so easy to travel with. A lot of people will buy razors when they travel. And when you do that, you're wasting money. You're sacrificing quality, by the way. Maybe you buy a terrible disposable razor that doesn't have the kind of quality that Harry's does. And you're going to cut yourself. You're going to look bad. Harry's delivers high quality, travel friendly shave supplies at a great low price, just $2 per blade. Join the 10 million who have tried Harry's. Claim your special offer by going to harrys.com/arguments. Harry's founders, of course, were just two regular guys tired of getting ripped off and paying for overpriced gimmicks, vibrating heads, heated blades, handles that look like a prop in a sci-fi movie. Those are just some of the tactics that the leading brand has used to overcharge us for years, but Harry's makes quality, durable blades at a fair price, just $2 per blade, and they've got a 100% quality guarantee. If you don't love your shave, let them know and they will give you a full refund. This summer, refresh your wallet and your face with a Harry's Razor trial set. It comes with weighted ergonomic handle for an easy grip, 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade for a close shave, rich lathering shave gel that will leave you smelling great, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy on the go. Listeners of my show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/arguments. Make sure you go to harrys.com/arguments to redeem your offer and let them know we sent you to support the show.
Anyway, so Ken Buck clearly thought he was setting up a good argument. and his question was, his set of questions were, okay, volume one, you go through, you talk about conspiracy. He starts to say collusion and he says, no, conspiracy. And this is when I thought maybe he was just engaged in honest questioning. He's like, you exonerated the president on conspiracy, right? And Mueller says, yep. And then he says, but in volume two, you didn't exonerate the president. Mueller goes, yep. And then he says, and you could charge him after he leaves office, right? He says, yep. And then he's like, I'm trying to understand why you would exonerate somebody for one crime, but make no decision on the other crime. And you're sitting there going like, could I volunteer? Right. Again, yeah. you just.
Wait a minute. You exonerated him on theft, but you didn't exonerate him on murder. Explain yourself. How is this? Don't I have you on a contradiction? Well, he didn't steal anything. And, he just murdered somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. Yeah.
I didn't think of that potential answer.
Yeah. And God, I was just hoping, again, this is one of these caught off guard moments that I was just hoping that Mueller might be like, well, right, because the president didn't collude with Russia, but he did obstruct justice.
Exactly. That's got to be somebody who didn't read the report, right? He's like, well, I skimmed it and I saw something about he's fine here, but not fine here. Because that's a stupid question.
Although that was not the dumbest line of questioning. So we'll do the dumbest Republican line of questioning from somebody who very clearly has not read the report and does not get news outside of Fox News. And then we'll go back to what I predict will be the lead story on Fox News as they're attempting to get around.
Oh, I have a prediction
on
that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, good. Good. Oh, I definitely want to hear yours. The dumbest line of questioning came from Debbie Lesko from Arizona. And again, this was another one of these, like, okay, well, these are purple Western states. Her questioning was, did Attorney General William Barr say anything inaccurate in his summary of your report? And you could see Mueller sort of blink and look at her and be like, Are you clownhorning kidding me? Like, I called his office three times and sent a letter on March 27th that detailed all the ways in which that was totally misleading. And you could then see her look down and go, but he released the letter on March 24th. And Robert Mueller, in again, one of his longest answers on the day, said, right. And I sent my letter on March 27th telling him all the things that were wrong with that. it was truly a moment of somebody that like has been drinking the Kool-Aid
they're so drowning in Fox Newsdom that Fox probably didn't cover the fact that Mueller shot back at the Barr letter. They probably just covered the Barr letter forever. They're probably still covering the Barr letter. Hey, this just in. Barr said everything's fine.
The impartial Attorney General of the United States said nothing to see here.
So it was probably news to her that he had written that letter maybe or something.
I am, again, loath to infer, but that's the only possible explanation that I can come up with. So what did you think was the right wing spin that landed that is going to hit on Fox News?
Well, that it's again landed in the sense that no matter what, it would have been on Fox News. You know, like it doesn't. That doesn't, there's nothing restricting what can be on Fox News as a victory. Like there's no, you know, it doesn't have to be like it was factual or landed or it was a good question or anything like that. But I think that it'll be wall to wall coverage of Mueller refuses to answer the question of whether or not the fact that X number of lawyers on his team donated to Hillary and were at the inauguration party or whatever. I almost said inauguration. That's not right. We're at some sort of campaign party. Refuses to answer whether or not that's a conflict of interest. I think that'll be the wall to wall Fox News. What do you think?
So I think, and let me say, I might be slightly persuaded, right? Like I think general questions about his demeanor and about the refusal to answer questions, that may well be because, that has more of a basis in fact and will overlap with some of the things that mainstream news reporting is going to say, right? Like, look, it's just factually true that on more than 100 occasions, Robert Mueller said, I'm not going to answer that.
Yeah.
So you're probably right. When I was watching the first half, I thought that the deftly executed, totally unfair political hit job came from Congressman Collins from Georgia, right? The ranking minority member. And he did this. He said, Director Mueller, I heard you just answer Jerry Nadler. And by the way, Jerry Nadler did a nice job with his intro 5 minutes. Not surprised by that. And it was sort of undone by the fact that the five or six Democrats who came after him were pretty terrible. But Nadler did a pretty good job and got him to say that you didn't investigate on collusion. You investigated on the narrow question of conspiracy. Right? And Mueller says yes. So then Collins gets up and says, you just told Congressman Nadler that collusion and conspiracy are two different things. Yes. But isn't it true that in your report you said that colloquially they're really the same thing? And here Mueller was sort of confused and he was like, what are you talking about? Where is it in my report? And Collins says, yeah, it's volume one, page 180. I refer you to that. And you say collusion is largely synonymous with conspiracy, end quote. So I want to know, why are you now saying that collusion and conspiracy are different things? And Mueller said, I would just have to defer to my report. I would like to. And then Collins is like, look, I only get 5 minutes. We're moving on. Okay. So that was the kind of classic lawyer cross-examination hit job. And again, it illustrates the ridiculousness of this farce of a set of proceedings, because when that happens to your witness in a trial, what you do is call back up your witness for redirect, right? Mm. And you say, hey, you were just asked this question and you gave this partial answer. Would you like to expand on that answer? And then you let the witness expand on that answer and clarify the record, right? That's how you get around it. In this case, the argument is preposterous and stupid. And again, we linked up, I'm going to link in the show notes, we linked it on our Twitter account, a great way to watch these hearings and fact check is to have the Mueller report open in front of you. And you will see that uniformly, Democrats accurately quoted from the Mueller report, Republicans barred the Mueller report. Here's what that section actually says. This is volume one, page 180. As an initial matter, this office evaluated potentially criminal conduct that involved the collective action by multiple individuals, not under the rubric of collusion, but through the lens of conspiracy law. In so doing, we recognize that the word collude appears in the acting attorney general's August 2, 2017 memorandum. It has frequently been invoked in public reporting, and it is sometimes used in antitrust law, but it is not a specific offense or theory of liability found in the U.S. Code, nor is it a term of art in federal criminal law. To the contrary, even as defined in legal dictionaries, comma, collusion is largely synonymous with conspiracy as that crime is set forth in a general federal conspiracy statute. So it's the exact opposite of what Collins was saying, right? What Mueller said in his report was collusion has a broader context in general public discourse, but it's not a legal term. To the extent that it is a legal term, it means the same thing as conspiracy. So we're going to look only at the narrower aspect of conspiracy. So when Collins said colloquially collusion, your report said collusion and conspiracy are the same thing. It in fact says the exact opposite.
Hold on though. Like what? Sorry. What even is the Republican version of this? Like what? I have a hard time even understanding what the Pizzagate is here. Like what?
That's because the Republican Pizzagate here is crazy, right? It is there were two different arguments that were advanced, and both of them are nonsense, and also they contradict each other. but here's where they are. Collins's argument, as picked up by Sensenbrenner and Steve Shabbat and others. And I mention Sensenbrenner and Shabbat because those two were two of the biggest cheerleaders of the Clinton impeachment. They were two of the House managers appointed to prosecute Bill Clinton for during the Clinton impeachment. And so it is particularly hypocritical coming out of those guys. But the argument that those guys were crafting, and again, shockingly, it's all men. I should be clear. It's all men who crafted this argument. It's not. There were one or two Republican congresswomen on the panel. I don't want to be accused of saying that. This is still not a very diverse party. Anyway, their argument is Robert Mueller assembled a team of angry Democrats who then crafted this report that, by the way, totally exonerates him. That's a bananas in pajamas level argument.
Exactly. This witch hunt is a total exoneration. What?
Yeah, because that's what they do, right?
Yeah, that's when they got the witches. That's what happened. They're like, you are accused of being a witch and using supernatural powers to curse the other townspeople, and we find you cleared of all charges.
Yeah,
you may go about your business.
The harm was really putting them into that elaborate balance to see if they weighed the same as the duck, right? Like it was the trauma of being weighed, not the actual burning. So I think this argument is meant to fall into that kind of general throwing garbage at volume two of the report to say, look, like, and again, this comes from volume one, but you heard them specifically because volume two details 10 specific instances of where the president has committed a crime that Republicans are sort of left with, well, yeah, but, you know, that's just Democrat spin. And they're going to say, look, one evidence of that is there's this huge difference between collusion and conspiracy, and he said, you know, it wasn't fair that there's no collusion, that wasn't one of his findings, but he even said collusion and conspiracy are the same thing in his report. That's where I think they're going to go with that. The argument that was even crazier was advanced by Guy Reschenthaler, a young guy, I think from Pennsylvania, not somebody I have ever seen before or that we are likely to hear from again, whose argument was essentially to Robert Mueller, it is so unfair that you have gathered together all of these crimes that the president has committed without indicting him.
I saw this guy maybe.
Yeah.
Unless they had two of them.
That's one of those where you just think, like, is there an inner Democratic?
To clarify, is this the guy who tried to ask, like, are you familiar with the statute on special counsels that is, by the way, no longer in effect? Is it that guy? Because if not, then there was essentially two of the same person doing the same questioning.
Yeah, no, I was looking down at my notes. That was not the same guy.
They tried again. Like, it was apparently such a good plan. They're like, let's run it back. Let's do the exact same thing. Because I caught this second guy and he did exactly what you're saying. So I guess second time's the charm.
I guess.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by ClearBank. ClearBank is changing the way entrepreneurs raise money with equity-free capital. Co-founder Michelle Romanow, star of Canada's Dragon's Den, Canadian version of Shark Tank, co-founded ClearBank with her partner Andrew D'Souza after seeing how many companies were willing to part with precious equity in exchange for a bigger marketing budget. ClearBank believes that founders shouldn't have to give up a piece of their company to fund marketing and inventory expenses. ClearBank makes equity-free investments from $10,000 to $10 million and can get you a term sheet in less than 20 minutes. They charge a small flat rate fee for the capital, and you pay them back using a win-win revenue share. This is not a loan. There is no interest rate, no fixed maturation date, no personal guarantees, no credit checks, and no financial covenants. ClearBank has relationships with marketing agencies, e-commerce professionals, venture capitalists, accountants, and more, giving you a true unfair advantage in the market. ClearBank invested over $150 million in 2018 and is on track to invest over $1 billion this year. So if you are doing over $10,000 a month in revenue, find out how you can receive ClearBank Capital by getting your 20-minute term sheet at clearbank.com/lawpod. That's clear, B-A-N-C, bank with a C, .com/lawpod. ClearBank, stop pitching and get back to doing what you love, growing your business.
Here's what they're doing, right? And this is how you know that your legal case is really, 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 really weak, right? Because one of the things that truly, right, like as of right now, clearly, truly motivates Robert Mueller is the idea of faith in the process, right? He's a prosecutor. This doesn't surprise me, right? Because we've talked about this, you know, it's kind of one of the general... you know, we've talked about it on Law and Awful Movies, right? They're like, you know, how do you, if you're in the criminal justice system, like, how can you work as a prosecutor knowing that you might accidentally prosecute an innocent person? Or how can you work as a defense attorney knowing that you might defend somebody who's guilty, right? And the answer, the thing you have to believe to go to bed at night is, I believe in this process, right? I believe in the adversarial system. And I believe that the checks that we have in place in the adversarial system make that unlikely. And, you know, if it's a bad outcome, then it's a bad outcome. But at least I can say I went through a fair process. And you see this in volume two of the Mueller report after concluding that, as per the OLC memorandum, that Trump can't be indicted. Mueller then sort of wrestles with this idea. He's like, OK, so, you know, in a sense, it's not fair for me to weigh in because if Trump were indicted, he would get to have a lawyer who would get to cross-examine our witnesses and would get to go through the documents and he would be able to avail himself of this process. We can't indict him, so he can't take advantage of that process. I get that from a lawyer's perspective, but from a political perspective, that makes no sense whatsoever. Right. Like that we are not talking about the standard for impeachment. There's no standard for impeachment. Right. The standard is what does the Senate vote on? This is not locking someone up for the rest of their lives. This is not executing Donald Trump. This is not guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. This is this person still fit to be president? And if you believe the president more likely than not has committed a crime, then in my view, then your ethical obligation in the Senate is to vote for impeachment. And I say that about a Democrat, right? I say that about a Republican, right? It's not the same standard. And I think Mueller seems to think that it is the same standard. So I think Guy here and the other Republicans have seized on that and been like, oh, see, there's fundamental procedural fairness at stake. And you're like, that there is not. This is an investigation, right? If this were a grand jury, like that's the analogy. And it's another missed point, right? The analogy of the Mueller report is not to the end of a trial, right? It is to a grand jury handing down an indictment, right? Mm. And that is every bit as one-sided as the Mueller report, right? When you are the subject of an investigation by a grand jury, you don't get input in that. You don't get told about it. You don't get to cross-examine the witnesses. It is just the prosecutor going to the grand jury, and the grand jury says, is there sufficient evidence here to hand down an indictment? It's weird because here there's only a one-sided grand jury, right? There is, Mueller can say, as the grand jury, we think there is insufficient evidence to indict, as they do on conspiracy, or our hands are tied by OLC.
Yeah, okay, but here, that's the obvious difference here, because I think that this will probably be a Republican talking point, because it kind of sounds like something, you know, like, how dare you not right, give yeah. the president the right? There's no due process. He doesn't get to weigh in. He doesn't get to, like, cross-examine. But, like, you can't have an investigation. This isn't a police investigation of, like, a minor drug dealer or something. And then if you find him, there's not enough evidence to convict, then you don't, you know, like, do a press conference where you talk about what evidence there was. This is, they've done an investigation, and part of their conclusions there is, we are handing this off. Like, we can't do this. We're leaving this for other remedies, including, but not limited to, impeachment. So imagine if that's what they did. If they're like, well, we can't do anything. It's not our place to really do anything here. Here, we'll refer to you this blank report, because we don't want to, you know, we can't make the president look bad. So use this blank paper to make a decision. That doesn't make any sense. You have to do it this way.
Yeah, no, that is exactly right. And I would add that, particularly given that the independent counsel statute was allowed to expire, right, that we know that all of this is sui generis, right? Like, this is you there is no precedent for how a special counsel is to prepare findings now that there is no independent counsel statute that used to set up exactly how this was done, right? So, you know, all of the questions that Republicans asked are sort of like, you know, has this ever been done before? I mean, you could see, I mean, it was, again, some of the only times in which Mueller showed any, you know, passion or involvement, that his response was, well, no, but right, this is the president, and I don't have any guidance, and I'm doing my best, right? I'm bending over backwards. Yeah. I want to say, I want to detour briefly into the OLC memorandum, because I want to explain. I know we've covered this on the show. We may have new listeners who are listening to our take here, and it's always worth a reminder. This was an October 16th, 2000 memorandum written by the Office of Legal Counsel. Okay, those were individuals who were appointed by President Clinton to then opine on a sitting president's amenability to indictment and criminal prosecution. So this is just an opinion letter from lawyers appointed by President Clinton asking the question, can President Clinton be indicted for criminal conduct while being in office? It has binding effect on the Department of Justice, because that's the internal regulations, right? The Department of Justice must follow what the OLC says, but courts don't have to, right? And in fact, as we've talked about previously on the show, it is my view that a court is highly unlikely to embrace the conclusions in this OLC memorandum. It's just a memo. It's just a lawyer saying, hey, and the easiest way to think about that is, right, President George W. Bush made extensive use of the Office of Legal Counsel in writing memoranda saying, yeah, it's our opinion that torture is perfectly fine. That's
right.
That's just an opinion letter, right? And here's the analysis, right? So the top line finding is, the indictment or criminal prosecution of a sitting president would unconstitutionally undermine the capacity of the executive branch to perform its constitutionally assigned functions. And then they go through the case law and they say, looking at the Nixon cases and Clinton versus Jones, right, which held that the president could be required to respond to civil proceedings while in office, he say, we believe that these are consistent with the OLC's analysis in 1973, which, by the way, were lawyers appointed by Richard Nixon arguing that Richard Nixon couldn't be indicted, right? We think it's the same. And then the memorandum says the cases embrace the methodology applied in this memorandum of constitutional balancing. That is, they balance the constitutional interests underlying a claim of presidential immunity against the governmental interests in rejecting that immunity. And notwithstanding Clinton, that is Clinton v. Jones, conclusion that civil litigation regarding the president's unofficial conduct would not unduly interfere with his ability to perform his constitutionally assigned functions, we believe that Clinton and the other cases do not undermine our earlier conclusion that the burdens of criminal litigation would be so intrusive as to violate the separation of powers. And look, there's a lengthy memo, but that's pretty much it. They say if you could indict a sitting president, that would just make it too hard for him to do his job. And there is a super easy response to this. I've changed my mind on this, right? I used to believe you couldn't indict a sitting president for this reason. I suppose it might be fair game to say, am I doing it because I'm a liberal and I hate Trump? Whatever. Lobby that criticism against me if you want. It wasn't Randall Eisen, but it was another prosecutor friend of mine who said, yeah, you can indict and then you can either name somebody as an unindicted co-conspirator or you can indict and stay the proceedings.
Right.
And in my view, that makes total sense. Right. It solves the only problem that they've identified. Right. Which is, yeah, you probably don't want the police to show up and haul your president away in handcuffs. That would make it hard for him to do his job. I agree with that.
Well, my response to that would be they have Fox News in prison, right? That's yeah. His job is to sit and watch Fox News and tweet. So,
yeah. And there are certainly prisons where you can golf, right? So, yeah. leaving aside that job, the other reason that I have to believe that this OLC memorandum is not well founded is all of the cases from the Supreme Court on down that have dealt with absolute claims of presidential immunity have gone the other way, right? Hmm. The Supreme Court has very clearly, that's U.S. v. Nixon, said the president does not have absolute immunity, right? Like they rejected the Nixon view of, you know, it's not illegal if the president does it. The question is, what are the contours? What are the scope of that immunity? And the OLC memorandum is based upon, right, the idea of absolute immunity. It says that a president must be completely immune from all criminal process. And I can't see any fair-minded court. So I'm allowing a potential Andrew was wrong on this Supreme Court. But I can't see a fair-minded court agreeing with that notion of a blanket prohibition, right? And if I were sitting on the Supreme Court and Trump's lawyers were asking it, I would say, okay, so it's your view that the president can't be assigned a speeding ticket, right? He's not on his way to do it. He's just on vacation, he's hit by a red light camera. You're saying he can't pay that ticket. What's the basis for that, right? Is it really that the 3 seconds to write a check and pay that ticket is interfering with his presidential duties? Is that seriously the position you're taking in front of us? And then you just kind of move from there and you say, okay, now that we agree that some criminal processes apply to the president, where's the bright line? Where's the threshold? Or what standard do we have to balance these interests, right? How can we determine the difference between? Because I certainly agree with you. I don't want the DC police to, walk up to the White House and haul the president away in handcuffs in the middle of, you know, signing a bill into law. Like, that would violate separation of powers. But where's the line? Where's the test? Or what are the interests? And I don't know that there's I haven't read good arguments beyond the kind of general principles.
Yeah, I think lay people over the course of this, myself included, maybe have gotten a little confused and thought of that rule that you can't indict a sitting president or whatever. Like, I've thought of that as some like constitutional principle or something, you know, like Jefferson wrote that you could never do. But when you say that, I'm glad you clarified. It's just a memo, just like the horrible torture memo and just like other memos that you know, have aged out and been reversed or whatever. Is that right?
Yeah, that is 100% correct. And so, you know, we talk about the binding effect of this in our episode in which we talk about Don McGahn and Hope Hicks, right? It is the same position that the Trump administration has taken with respect to why they have told McGahn and Hicks not to testify, not to answer subpoenas to Congress. They've said, yeah, look, we have an OLC memorandum that says presidential aides have absolute executive immunity. They do, right? They have that memoranda. But when a court evaluates that memoranda, all of the cases have gone the other way, right? And that's why I'm confident that eventually Hope Hicks will be ordered by the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia to testify before Congress. And these are just, it's just a lawyer's opinion. Man, that's just like your opinion, man.
It's just like a lawyer's opinion, man.
That was a much better dude than I tried. I'm sorry.
Aggression will not stand, man.
I think that's a good way. I hadn't really thought about that as kind of needing the clarification. But if the main issue coming out of this testimony is going to be Robert Mueller's reliance on the OLC memorandum, one way for us as Democrats to take that back, right, to make it clear in this discussion is to emphasize the word memorandum, right? This is not, and you will see, right, that it is a memorandum opinion, right? So the right is going to have an interest in calling this the OLC opinion. We should be calling it the OLC memo. You know, messaging matters, and this is just words. So,
yeah, well, we're already pretty much out of time. I want to make sure you got to everything in your notes. Is there anything else we need to be aware of? Listeners need to know from these hearings?
Yeah. So a few things, and I'm just going to tick through since, yeah, we've
lightning round.
Yeah. Lightning round. Like I said, I thought the second half I thought was very effective given the confines of Mueller as a witness of, okay, there are three elements to the obstruction statute. That is correct. Let's talk about those three elements, right? And those three elements are, number one, there must be an obstructive act. Number two, it must have a nexus to an ongoing proceeding. And number three, it must have been done with corrupt intent. And that is the direct application of 18 U.S.C. 1512C. We've talked about that before. So they correctly stated the standards. Mueller agreed to that. And then again and again, and I thought really, really effective with the decisions on instructing Don McGahn to fire Robert Mueller, right? And hoping, I guess, that might spark some humanity in him. Like, hey, remember when the president told his lawyer to fire you? did that anger you? Well, that's in my report. So, you know, it was a good try. But I think very effectively went through and said, look, here was the obstructive act. That's from your report, right? Yes. Here was the nexus to an official proceeding. You're an official proceeding, right? Yes. Here was the corrupt intent. Well, and this was where Mueller would push back, but time and time again, they were like, you mention in the report that the president did so in order to, you know, throw suspicion off of himself. And ultimately, you know, Mueller agreed to that. They did that with McGahn. They did that, I thought, really effectively with the president. Then once McGahn wouldn't fire Mueller, telling Corey Lewandowski to go tell Jeff Sessions to curtail the scope of the investigation. And then also the witness tampering stuff with Manafort and others. So ultimately, you know, I think that if there is an impeachment, you will see those articles of impeachment that the primary article will be 18 U.S.C. 1512C and will follow the testimony. So there was some good lawyerly like laying the groundwork here. And then finally, I liked that near the end, Greg Stanton did what I was screaming about on Twitter, which was reminding us all that Robert Mueller is a Republican.
Yeah.
and I hope Democrats can continue to remember that as you be prepared for the onslaught. Like, the Republicans were not shy about telegraphing this, this is Bob Mueller's team of angry Democrats. That's nonsense. And so I thought that was good. What about you? Did anything else stand out for you?
Well, I agree. If there's, I want to pick up on that last thing, and then I want to, if you don't mind, use an extremely tortured analogy to sum up my feelings, in Thomas fashion. But I think if there's one thing that maybe it would be worth trying to like use on your, Republican family members or something, it would be, when we make these Bill Clinton comparisons, and correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, it would almost be like if you were to take the equivalent of what that was like, of who Ken Starr was and how that went, it would be like saying AOC should be investigating Trump for like, what, 6 years or four, however long it was. And then like, what would we get in that report? You know, like the difference between Mueller and Ken Starr, a Republican in Mueller and how he's handled this, is huge. And that's, I mean, honestly, we should have gotten somebody like AOC. Like, we should be allowed a Democratic hack or something. You know, like, that's what's been done in the past. I don't know why it is that all of a sudden the most corrupt president in history gets the best possible kid gloves treatment in his investigation. So that would be something that maybe could break through. Like, the equivalent of Ken Starr would be, I don't know who you could pick that would be, but it would be almost like, I don't know, Maxine Waters or something. Like, allowing that person to.
I like AOC because AOC triggers conservatives so
exactly.
badly.
Exactly. It probably makes the point better.
I think that's a really, really good point. And I think that dovetails with it's a great defensive point when they mention, well, you know, he had Peter Strzok working for him and Peter Strzok hated Donald Trump. And you're like, yeah, but the boss is a Republican. So let me ask you this, like, if you're a Republican and your boss is a Democrat, who do you think is influencing policy here?
I think the better answer, as I think you've touched on, and that Mueller, they kind of got to toward the end of the hearing that I saw, was you don't ask people their political. It's actually incredibly inappropriate to ask someone's political affiliations before hiring them to a job like this. You don't do it. There's literally no counterfactual here. It's not like, whoa, well, how did he end up with these Democrats? There's no other scenario in which he first screens people by their political affiliations and then builds a team that way. And by the way, what would that team be? Are they only allowed to have Republicans? Or is it just people, you're going to find some robots who have somehow never expressed a political opinion? What? There's no actual alternative that makes any sense there.
I love both of those points. I think they are dead on. And right, the idea that like prosecutors who, you know, again, tend to be a more conservative lot, especially career prosecutor, right? Like, mm-hmm. You know, if this were somebody convicted of a street crime and you were like, well, yeah, you know, I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter and the prosecutor's a Republican, like, you'd be like, get out of here with that, right? Like, I'm sorry, you know, this is the way in which the judicial, you know, the judicial system works. And,
yeah. Plus when you're, you're cross examined or whatever, you're on the stand, you're confronted with evidence. Oh, it shows here these emails and this text message chain in which you said, hey, I'd like to buy some drugs from you. And then your answer is, what political party are you asking me this question? Like, no, actually we just care about the evidence that we're seeing in front of our eyes. Like, the facts are the facts. There's no, yeah, it doesn't matter. You don't ask what political party the prosecutor is.
Yeah, no, that is exactly right. And as you've pointed out, those were the moments in which Robert Mueller came alive, right? In defending
not enough,
the integrity of his hiring practices. Well,
yeah.
You know, it
not enough.
We said this was a problem. So,
yeah. Well, that's a good time for my tortured analogy here. It really struck me this idea that Mueller is just going to be this rigid, by the book, only going to talk about the report, but not going to read the report. It, like, on one part of me thought, like, well, is it is it almost what we need here, that like he's going to be rigidly just, you know, sticking to norms? Is that what we need at a time like this when all the norms are dead? You know, is that what we need? And I was thinking, it's almost like you're on the Titanic and the thing is sinking, you know, and everybody's scrambling. But then Mahler's like in a hallway somewhere. He's like, it says no running in this corridor. And you're like, but dude, where's scissors? The ship's in half. Like, what? It says no running in the corridor. Okay. And then somebody's like, you know, well, maybe we need this, because if we had stuck to the rules, we'd never have sunk the ship to begin with. If we were running the ship at the speed it was supposed to go at, we would have been able to veer off course. It's like, okay, and then we all sink and die. Like, it's just, it's gone. You know, like, we're past the no running in this corridor phase of this presidency and of our country, to be honest with you.
I couldn't agree more with that. and again, I mean, I just think it goes back to, I mean, you look at it. I was struck that there were several opportunities where Mueller almost, like, you could see, right? I mean, on the impeachment question, I think was the most obvious, where,
yeah,
you know, you could, yeah, see, cool, him,
dude,
saying, like,
you're really sticking to those principles, yeah, when you're like winking and saying, you mentioned a thing that, like, what? Okay, come on.
And that was him saying, I don't want to, it was clear, great, going into it, that he said, my goal is to get out of this testimony without giving a soundbite that Democrats can use to say, see, yeah, Bob Mueller says we should impeach. And he did that. And you might ask yourself why he would do that. You know, I think that's above my pay grade.
All right. Well, thank you, Andrew, for the rapid response. I know I enjoyed it and needed it, and I'm sure our listeners did as well. And thank you to Brian for being able to edit on short notice and get this out of there so that you folks can enjoy it right away. I know my first instinct as an OA fan and listener is I want to hear Andrew's take on this right away. And it's always great when we can do something early and make that happen. Well, I guess then it's time for the patron thanks. We got to thank our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats over at patreon.com/law, who have enjoyed, by the way, you've been pumping out, I don't even know what you're putting out on this feed. I keep getting notifications that you're putting out bonus materials. You've been pumping out bonus stuff for our fine patrons. Do you want to tease any of that, or let people know what they're missing if they're not on the patron feed?
Yeah, wow. So I have put up a couple of guest appearances that are extended, unedited interviews that, you know, if you like this show, you'll probably like me, you know, ranting about the insane state of our abortion laws to a bunch of Canadians. Mm. So that there's a lot of that on there. What we just released was it was basically half an extra episode on Tuesday's episode, where we were talking about the Emoluments Clause litigation. And there is a recent 1 month old decision by Ruth Bader Ginsburg with kind of an odd alignment in it that is going to, in my view, kind of drive the nail into the coffin of the D.C. Emoluments Clause case, right? And just to keep those straight, right, we've been talking about the Maryland case. That is the one brought by our buddy Brian Frosch, related to the state of Maryland and the entity of the District of Columbia alleging Emoluments Clause violations because of the anti-competitive theory. That was rejected by the Fourth Circuit. That left intact the lawsuit in the District of Columbia beginning in 2017, brought by members of Congress that alleged the violations of the Foreign Emoluments Clause by Donald Trump. And the theory there was that they were deprived of their opportunity to vote, right? Because the Foreign Emoluments Clause says the president can't get gifts from other nations unless Congress says so. And these were members of Congress. The Democrats were a minority in both the Senate and the House at the time, who filed a lawsuit that said, look, the Constitution says we get to vote on this. And because Trump is just taking their money, we don't get to vote on it. That's a better theory of standing. Yeah. And so I explain half an hour bonus why that theory is not going to fly at the D.C. Circuit. And you can blame our favorite justice, RBG, for this one. So really interesting.
I'm going to pop that into my earballs right away because that's hot off the presses. Just letting you know that, you know, we try to make it worthwhile for you patrons. We try to give you as much as we can, as much bonus stuff as we can. In addition to those discount tickets to our live show, 10 of which are left. Go check it out, patrons. If you've been sleeping and snoozing on buying your tickets, go do so. We can't wait to see you. It's going to be so much fun. I'm really excited for the live show. But also just patreon.com/law. Maybe you can't make this live show, but you know, there are going to be more. Maybe you'll want to take advantage of the patron benefits for those. So without further ado, let's thank our top patrons, starting with the Lanyard Podcast. Hi from Reddit's OpenArg subreddit. Oh, and I will say, if us recording early has messed up anyone's patron name change, you know, we're sorry, but can't be avoided. That's the cost of doing business here. Am I doing this right?
And that Reddit, I just want to plug. I do pop in occasionally. I'm not a big Redditor. I don't know if you have a Reddit account. That is reddit.com/r/openargs, OpenArgs. So
I think I've made like probably 7 or 8 Reddit accounts in my past because I forget what I've done every single time. So I'll get my S together. Can they make us like verified users within the subreddit and we'll come chime in? I think they can do that. Maybe that could be fun. Bill Burr walks into a bar and punches him. I duck. Attorney General O.J. Simpson's Department of Justice. Hotspear.com. Keep your valuables and yourself safe at the beach. Munch McCornhole. It's legal. It's advice. It's not legal advice. Ask your podcast if legal advice is right for you. I love that those two go together. They're not intentional, but it works. Let me pause this to express my personal view that crime is good. We're not lawyers, but you can take our advice. SummitShuffleboard.com. Say punish me, daddy, to weird the judge out of sentencing you.
Do not take legal advice from Patreon names.
But I, as not a lawyer, encourage people to do that because I'm not a lawyer. So you can't disbar me. Can they diss second chance bar me? I don't know. Ad Astra Per Aspera, Nate Drex, Dragonfly.eco, books about nature and the environment, reviews and interviews, Stuff in Polls, Resolve, the United States should adopt a policy to decrease clown horns. Oh, no way. Valerie Galloway, well-deserved patron number 239, Darth Mandypants, Youngster Dustin would like to battle, Ricky, Minnie, Rufy, and all the characters here at Imaginary Property, Brewing, 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. Have a great weekend, everybody. Ooh, a little early weekend wishes. Maybe, I think that means people should take Friday off. You know, why not?
I agree.
Clarence Thomas is a misunderstood mime. Jennifer Cratch, Barbara Lawal is your queen and benevolent redeemer. The cure for ultravirus. Thomas's frustration with the patron names is starting to show. Oh, I'm having a great time today. Make Worcester... I already like this. Make Worcestershire pronounceable again. That's awesome. Stephen Balticatai Sandoval, Adam Costa, Jay Aldenwalt. My religion includes erecting a 40-foot middle finger statue. Read Factfulness by Hans Rosling and Move Your Cognitive Bias Noodle. Claude Monet's Impressionist Swamp Thing paintings. Housing is a Human Right. Visit tenantresourcecenter.org. Suspect is The Purge, set in the late 80s with Cher and Frasier's dad. I used to be a lawyer like you, then I took an arrow in the knee. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. John Bilderback, Jason McClouta, The Registry Matters Podcast, The End is Nigh. Absolutely take GoToClownHornVoting.com advice from a podcast. Yes, Honey Buns, Eric Alsman. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew is a close second. Payne Strumpet, Michael C. Sampson, Trambolis, Colorado, where weed and shrooms are legal, but being homeless is a crime. Kiowa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Redaction Blackouts should now be called Bill Bars. And let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. Your turn, Andrew.
All right. Thank you to the Getting Off Podcast. Milo Meadsong, your trial combatant in Trial by Combat. Sam Buck, Cosmo, the Janus-headed karaoke legend. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. I demand trial by wombat. So I had, how did I get all the trial by combat stuff this week? But I like it. Trial by wombat. Seriously, we are due a Stormy Daniels legal genius update. That is correct.
No kidding.
Peace, love, and warm, squishy feelings. Wait, what are true pretenses? I like that. James Call. Only Trump could make David Barton look like a credible historian. Devin Nunes. As the arch nemesis of the taint team is canon now, right? Anonymous. Failing the Voight-Kampf test because you imagine McConnell as the tortoise. My avatar was a classical statue before Nazis made it a dog whistle. Ugh. David in Brooklyn. What is 12 centitones fighting the bourgeoisie, a Pythagorean commie? How many licks to the center of a Tootsie Pop? A one, a two, redacted. Sue, grab it and run, solicitors, commissioners for oath and threats issued. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Donate to RISIS and ACLU today. Optimus Prime's brown bottle flu. Oh, for God, Don Don, who is it? Mr. Fletch reference. My favorite Share song is If I Could Toll the Statute of Limitations. That is an awesome reference. I love that. Derek, today I learned Sideshow Bob's last name is Terwilliger. Justin with a boring Patreon name. Well, we love you anyway, Justin. Ironically, this all ends with Epstein and Dersh getting screwed by boys. Concurrence, read factfulness to develop a more reality-based worldview. A string of unmovable noodles.
That's a good one.
Hey, Thomas, explain this Patreon name. Rhonda thinks Governor Dunleavy is a clown horn. Congrats on 300, OA. Please come back to the Bay Area. Okay.
Nice.
Volunteer with Camp Quest this summer, campquest.org. Abacus Flinch, Soggy Pants. There's always legal advice in the gelato stand. Follow at Sufferbox Games on Twitter for strategic card games. Dan Gleeballs. Half. Phil McCracken is next. I know. Half the patrons agree. Eli Bosnick should change his Patreon name. Yeah, now us too. Matthew Vernon, read Hunter S. Thompson's Richard Nixon obituary. Okay. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Aaron Grady, Heather L. Sakashite sent Boris back to the criminally corrupt country of his birth. Jeremiah's fancy microwave emporium. Ian and Allie. Can't wait for the live OA show. Us neither. Eli Bosnick, Zabby, Joey Salads. Wait, no, Kevin Costner. Mitchell, my cult leader could beat up your cult leader. Well, I want my TTTBE, Mark Knopfler. Fantastic. G, Zachary Terwilliger. And of course, our all-time great, our number one, the top Hall of Famer, he who shall never be dethroned, Conrad Michaels. Thank you all so much.
Yes. And now it is time for the newly named T3BE, Terminator T3BE. 3 Bar Exam. T3BE, here we go.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Oh, the graphic of you as the T3 in the opening arguments Facebook community is worth the price of admission, which is zero. So, you know, you should all...
Yeah, if you enjoy that meme made by the amazing, the incomparable Ben Thompson, he does memes like that for pretty much every single, and maybe multiple Philosophers in Space episode, and they're always that funny. Like, it's the best. So yeah, Ben Thompson gets a shout out for that T3BE meme, and he does amazing work, and especially in Philosophers in Space. So thanks, Ben. So, Andrew, let's go ahead and do the T3BE question. I don't know why we are doing it, because we already know that the result will be I'll narrow it down to two answers and guess the wrong one, but whatever. I guess we'll go through the motions.
Well, we have a contracts question for you, so maybe this will change your luck around a little bit. Thomas, a mother whose adult son was a law school graduate, contracted with a tutor to give the son a bar exam preparation course. If my son passes the bar exam, the mother explained to the tutor, he has been promised a job with a law firm that will pay $55,000 a year.
Hmm.
The tutor agreed to do the work for $5,000, although the going rate was $6,000. Before the instruction was to begin, and before any payment was made, the tutor repudiated the contract.
Huh.
Although the mother or the son reasonably could have employed for $6,000 an equally qualified instructor to replace the tutor, neither did so. The son, because he's an idiot, failed the bar exam and the law firm refused to employ him. it can be shown that had the son received the tutor's instruction, he would have passed the bar exam.
Wow.
So, if the mother and the son join as plaintiffs and sue the tutor for breach of contract, how much, if anything, are they entitled to recover? So, totally straightforward question, totally straightforward answers. Here we go. A, $1,000, because all other damages could have been avoided by employing another equally qualified instructor.
Final answer, A.
B, $55,000, because damages of that amount were within the contemplation of the parties at the time that they contracted. C, nominal damages only, because the mother was not injured by the breach and the tutor made no promise to the son. Or D, nothing, because neither the mother nor the son took steps to avoid the consequences of the tutor's breach.
All right, I take that back. Yeah, no, this is a little more difficult. It's definitely not $55,000. That's insane.
I love this question, and I'm not, will not prejudice you or our listeners in any way, because in my view, as a lawyer, I think all four of those answers have reasons that you could understand why you would choose those answers.
All right,
That's, I'm looking forward to it.
But, okay, yeah. No, I thought it was going to be straightforward, and then I got to some of the other ones, and you're right. This is a tough question. Okay, so, yeah, a lot of wrinkles to this one, because the mother contracted with the tutor, and then you're trying to collect damages based on the fact that the son lost out on a job because of this contract falling through. And not only that, there's that component to it, but also they didn't even try to replace the tutor, which they totally could have done. So like, I was leaning toward 1,000 because, okay, you've agreed, we've talked about this before. You've kind of got a contract, but you want to be able to break the contract if it's worth it to you. So like, I guess hypothetically the tutor had agreed for 5,000, but then the tutor might think my time could make more money with someone else. I'm going to just break this contract and go tutor someone else for 6,000 or 7,000 or whatever. And then in which case I think it would be reasonable to say, all right, well then you owe me some money here, like the difference in the rate. I think that would maybe be reasonable. But now that I'm looking through this again, the fact that nobody even tried to hire another tutor, and the fact that it was the mother who contracted I'm trying to get the exact words. The tutor agreed to do mother whose adult son contracted with a tutor to give the son bar exam prep, which means just listening to opening arguments, by the way. They also could have done that for free. So that's answer $0, because they could have listened to opening arguments. Did I win? The kiss ass answer. Does that one work? No. Tutor before the instruction was begun and before any payment was made, the tutor repudiated the contract. So, I mean, but that's another wrinkle. Now I'm just catching that. Before the instruction was to begin and before any payment was made, the tutor repudiated the contract. So nothing's happened. Like, they've signed, but there was no, could you almost say there was no consideration? Or is the fact that, because they haven't paid anything, but is the fact that you signed or something, that you agreed to pay something, does that count as a consideration? I don't know. Okay, let me go through the answers. 1,000, because all other damages could have been avoided by employing another equally qualified instructor. I mean, that is plausible. B, 55,000, because damages of that amount were within the contemplation of the parties at the time they contracted. I don't really think that could possibly be it. I mean, I think when you get out of a contract and then refuse to even look for somebody to replace the person, I'd be very surprised if it's that answer. So I'm going to eliminate B. C, nominal damages only, because the mother was not injured by the breach and the tutor made no promise to the son. I actually really like that answer now that I've looked through everything again, because in order for there to be damages, I think it's like, who did this cause damage to? You know, like it was somebody else, not the people involved, not the mother, you know, like from the mother's perspective, it's nominal damages only, because I don't think you could prove that. I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think the son not getting the job would qualify as like damages to the party in this contract, but I could be wrong. D, nothing, because neither the mother nor the son took steps to avoid the consequences of the tutor's breach. Now that's, oh gosh, this is hard. This is hard. A, C, and D. I think B is the only one I really don't think it is. A, C, and D seem really plausible. I think in true fashion, this is going to be Thomas narrows it down and picks the wrong one. I'm really leaning towards C and D. And that makes me worried because I don't know how to differentiate them. So C is nominal damages only. I don't know what exactly those nominal damages would be. Usually when it says that, it's like the cost of the paper that you printed out the I don't know what that is because the mother, but I really like the because the mother was not injured by the breach and the tutor made no promise to the son. I like that part. And then there's D, nothing, because neither the mother nor the son took steps to avoid the consequences of the tutor's breach. I actually think that is maybe it. You know what? I can't wait for this to be the one I went with that's wrong. I'm going to go with D, nothing, because they made no effort. So like if they sign a contract, no money is exchanged, the tutoring doesn't even start, and then they make no effort to replace the tutor, I think I'm going to go with D, nothing, because neither the mother nor the son. You know, I think Teresa made a point that my coin flip is at 100%. Should I just flip a coin at this point? My coin flip does better than I do at narrowing down to the last answer. Maybe I should. No, I'm a professional. I can't be seen doing that. My practice will never take off if that's the case. All right, I'm flipping again. This is going to be so painful when I get this wrong. I'm going to go with C. I'm going to go with C. God damn it. I can't decide. I can't. Brain aneurysm. All right. C, final answer. I can't wait to be wrong. I'm done. Final answer, C.
All right. And if you want to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE and give your reasons, your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune, which, as you know, is not guaranteed.
All right. Sorry for that painful T3BE. By the way, there's some people saying it should be 3TBE. That just doesn't sound as good.
No, totally. T3BE.
T3BE, because of the Terminator 3 part, and B, it just sounds better, and it's like C-3PO, you know, kind of has the, it just has the, you know, the flow to it. So it's T3BE. Let's put that issue to rest. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Andrew, for getting us this rapid response. Thanks for nothing, Bob Mueller, and we'll see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.